Last June, during one of our Please Explain segments, we learned about the Human Microbiome Project, a survey of all the microbes that live in and on the human body and their roles in keeping us healthy. On this week's Please Explain, we are taking a look at the communities of microbes in our homes and hospitals and other buildings and the ways their presence and absence may influence our health and well-being. Then joining us are Rob Dunn from the Department of Biology at North Carolina State University. He's the project director of The Wildlife of Our Homes and author of The Wildlife of Our Bodies, Predators, Parasites, and Partners That Shape Who We Are Today. It's published by Harper. Also, Jessica Green, associate professor and director of the Biology and Built Environment Center at the University of Oregon. Hello and welcome to our show.
Thank you so much for having us.
And we're also inviting our listeners to join the conversation. If you have a question, you can give us a call at 646-829-3980, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Let's begin with you, Rob. Is this a relatively new field of science?
Both for us and in general, it has very new aspects. But the idea of studying the microbes around us and the life around us is really very old. Anton van Leeuwenhoek did great work on the microbes in the mouths of his neighbors way back in early Delft. And so it has a long history, but it also has a very new and sexy modern version.
Well, I was talking about the not just looking at specific microbes, but at communities of microbes and how they interact with each other. When did people start thinking about that?
Jessica is probably a better person to answer the question about communities of microbes and the first work there. But there are certainly lots of early antecedents to thinking about that. And then in the last few years, the last 10 years, there have been new tools for exploring those communities in lots of exciting new ways. But people have been thinking about these kinds of questions for a while.
Jessica, can you explain the kind of research you're doing at the BioB, the Biology and the Built Environment Center?
Yes. So as Rob said, ecologists and particularly microbiologists have been thinking about communities for over 100 years. It's just that tools that they've been using more recently have revealed the great diversity of microbes, because instead of using culture-based techniques where you try to grow microbes on a petri dish, for example, we can now yank the DNA out of the microbial cells and, based on the DNA sequences, see a lot about the variety of microbes that are in any environment and also the composition, what's there. And that's what we're doing at the Biology and Built Environment Center. We're studying buildings as ecosystems to understand what is the cause and what is the consequence of designing microbial ecosystems in the built environment.
And your research team doesn't just involve biologists, but also architects?
It does. Architects, building scientists, engineers, and biologists. And that's what's made it such an extraordinary process, is that I'm learning a great deal about design and architecture, and it's taken years of working with faculty and students and research associates in the architecture department to really understand what do architects care about in terms of design. And if we're going to think about microbial biodiversity in the built environment, what aspects of that are interesting to a designer?
Well, our ventilation and airflow are important in buildings. What are we likely to find in the air inside a typical home or an office building?
You're going to find everything that was spelled out at the beginning of the conversation, so bacteria, fungi, archaea, and viruses, and many human-associated microbes, as well as microbes that are really commonly found in dirt and air and on plants outside.
Rob?
In addition to those, you're also finding... the more people look in houses, the more things are found. And so, we also do a lot of work on insects. And so in addition to all the microbes in the air and the truly microscopic things, you have dust mites and you have forehead mites. And the average house we're finding has 100 species of arthropods. And so there's all this life that's floating around you, running around you. And every time somebody looks in some new place in a house, they find new things.
And I assume that's why you've called your project Wildlife in Our Homes.
Yeah, I mean, we really want to get a sense of, I mean, we walk around our homes, you know, thinking that we've sort of cleaned away the life, that we live by ourselves in our homes, along with the partners we've invited in, so say a dog or a spouse. But the truth is, I mean, we're just surrounded with all these other species, and these species that we live most intimately with, we seem to know the least about, which is an amazing state of affairs. And so people like Jessica have been doing work in this field for a while now, and have revealed really amazing things about all these partners and how much they do affect us every day.
Now, people send in samples from their homes to have you tested?
Yeah, so for we have all of our projects involve the public, and so we have, for the wildlife of our homes, we send people kits, and they sample various sites in their homes. They send the kits back to us, and then we essentially look at which genes are present on the swabs from these kits to get a sense of what's living in these selected places in people's homes. But what we want to get a sense of is what determines what other species you're living with. So how much does the outdoor climate matter? How much does whether or not you're living with a dog matter? How much does it matter, you know, if you're using antimicrobial wipes on every surface of your body and house? And so our approach is to involve the public and get lots of samples from lots of houses. And then Jessica, I think, has a very complimentary but more in-depth approach of looking in individual houses in detail and experimentally manipulating things. And so the hope is with those sorts of approaches we can move forward. But, I mean, it's amazing. Every time new samples come in, we see new things that are surprising.
Haven't you also looked at belly button microbes that way? Did people send in their belly button lint?
Yeah, I mean, I think the belly buttons have ruined my career because now people just come up to me and lift their shirts up. But but we did. So that's one of the ways some of this public work has started, was we started to do an outreach project where we would sample the microbes in people's belly buttons, or they would sample them and give us the swabs.
If our listeners are interested in signing up to get a kit, what do they have to do?
They just go to yourwildlife.org, and you can find out about all of our projects, from belly button microbes to house microbes to camel crickets to ants in your backyard.
And do different belly buttons have different microbes in them?
Oh, incredibly different. So just in the first 66 belly buttons that were swabbed, we found 2,800 different types of bacteria and all kinds of crazy things. I mean, so for example, we swabbed the science writer Carl Zimmer, and, you know, he's kind of a hero, so it was a very exciting swabbing event. He had bacteria, the closest relatives of which are known from the Marianas Trench at the bottom of the ocean. Hmm. And so you get all kinds of crazy individual examples like that. We're trying to understand, you know, what it means that species is there.
So we have both naval research and naval research.
Yeah.
Jessica.
One's much hairier than the other.
So Jessica, do I get to ask Rob a question?
Sure.
Great. So, Rob, for the Wildlife of Your Home project, are you doing any investigations about the link between arthropod diversity and microbial diversity in the home?
So for a subset of homes, we will have both extensive data on the arthropods that are present, some data on the microbes associated with those arthropods, and then data on the microbes in the homes.
That's great.
Jessica,
it's proven, that specific part of our project is being led by Michelle Trotwine at the Nature Research Center here in Raleigh. And I think we expected 10 or 15 arthropod species in homes. And they did my home first, and they found 110 species, and I was away when they did it. And I love arthropods, and I was sort of alarmed. And I was very relieved when the second home also had 100 species.
Now you may love arthropods, but what are arthropods for the rest of us?
So it's all of those segmented critters walking around your house. And so in the context of your house, you're getting millipedes, centipedes, spiders, insects. Mm-hmm. And so in my house, we had 15 species of spiders. We had this camel cricket that nobody knows anything about, carpet beetles.
And would most of those be invisible to us?
No, lots of them are visible, but not noticed.
Yeah. So we might not know that we had those spiders unless they bite us. Jessica, what are some of the most fertile environments for bacteria, fungi, viruses, and other microbes in the home?
I don't know if we know that. We know that surfaces harbor a higher biomass than air does, but and there are some materials that seem like copper, for example, seems to commonly have a lower biomass than wood, but we don't know a lot about how the types of materials that you might have in the home drive the diversity and composition of microbes. So I think Rob's home study is getting at that some, right? You're looking at different surfaces in the home.
Yeah, I mean, one thing we do know is that the different surfaces tend to be very different. And so, for example, if you were to give me a sample from your kitchen, I'd be very unlikely to confuse it with a sample from your bathroom. But there are interesting distinctions there. So, for example, we're finding that we can't tell samples from pillowcases and toilet seats apart, which is to say microbiologically they're not distinct.
And do we have any idea of why that is?
Well, I mean
they're they are in very different environments, and we put very different things onto them.
We don't.
Yeah, I mean, the take-home is you put your bottom on the toilet seat and then
your head
on
the pillowcase, we hope, anyway.
And we're finding something similar in classrooms. We're finding that if you study the surfaces of desktops versus the floors versus chairs versus the walls, those environments are very distinguishable from one another. But the chairs look the most like the human ecosystem. And that's because it's the environment that it's the most tightly coupled with humans because they're sitting on the chair. And the desktops are the next closely related to the human ecosystem or microbiome, and probably less so than chairs because the janitors come in every night and disturb the surfaces of the desktops.
Now, we did a Please Explain segment on the norovirus in March, and we learned about something that's been called toilet sneeze. Do either of you have you encountered that term in this research?
No, I don't know that term.
It's the mist.
You know
it's the.
I do not.
Well,
I just googled it though, and I see that I'm finding it on Please Explain your show.
Oh, gee.
Your toothbrush is the take-home message.
Yeah, if you are sick and you flush your toilet, there's a little mist that comes out, and it can affect the other things in your bathroom.
I've heard that.
Fecal shower.
Oh, that's what you call it. I like toilet sneeze better than fecal shower. Listen, we have to take a little break. When we come back, we'll talk about some of the other things that you have discovered, both positive and negative. And we'll take some calls from our listeners. Our phone number here is 646-829-3980. And my guests are Jessica Green, Associate Professor and Director of the Biology and the Built Environment Center at the University of Oregon, and also Rob Dunn from the Department of Biology at North Carolina State University, author of The Wildlife of Our Bodies, Predators, Parasites, and Partners That Shape Who We Are Today. And we're back with today's Please Explain segment with Rob Dunn and from the Department of Biology at North Carolina State University and Jessica Green, Associate Professor and Director of the Biology and the Built Environment Center at the University of Oregon. And we invite your calls at 646-829-3980. Jessica, Norman Pace, another researcher in this field, has looked closely at shower heads. Can you talk about what he's found?
He has found, I don't remember the details of what he's found in his shower head study. I just know that it alarmed people that there were microbes that were in shower heads.
Well, we find large communities of molds and bacteria on our shower curtains sometimes, and sometimes on the walls of the showers. Why there in particular?
Because
go for it, Jess.
Well, we know that moisture is a place that makes it possible for microbes to colonize and grow. So in the home in general, we typically think that moisture environments are going to harbor more diverse ecosystems. So it makes sense that there would be a great diversity of microbes on your shower head.
And if you don't have ventilation, it gets worse. But I'd imagine the kitchen might have the most pathogens, does it?
Well, I want to back up one second there and just say that, I mean, one thing that's important to say here is that there aren't places in your house that we know of that don't have microbes. And so when we say that there are microbes in the shower head, there are also microbes, you know, on the side of the shower. There are microbes on your ceiling. They're in the air. They're everywhere. And so I think one of the important questions is which microbes. As we use cleaners, I mean, even the antimicrobial wipes have microbes on them. I'll go back to the kitchen question, but I think it's a really common misconception that there are microbial and non-microbial places, and we're covered. Jess, is that fair?
I think so. I mean, what I remember from the showerhead study was that they found potentially pathogenic bacteria on the showerhead, and that was something that alarmed a large number of people. But just like Rob said, there are potential pathogens everywhere. They're in and on our body, and they're on all the surfaces in our home and in the air in our home.
Well, I guess the reason they were surprised is because water comes out of the shower head, and you'd think that there's a natural cleansing process there.
Microbes can make a living everywhere.
So should we wipe down surfaces regularly with antimicrobial soaps and wipes? Pause.
I have a – so this is not based on my research, but this is my opinion that we're in an era right now that advocates for microbial genocide. And I believe that this practice of attempting to sterilize – everything in our lives, if you think about it from an ecology point of view, when you remove a bunch of organisms from a particular space, what you're doing is you're making room for that to be recolonized by new individuals. So if you wanted to get rid of a few weeds in your garden outside, would you spray Roundup on the entire garden? You probably wouldn't, because your garden would very quickly get recolonized by weeds. So I think of that garden analogy inside the home or your office or school, any environment.
Mm-hmm. And there's a great study, the authors of which I'm going to forget right now, but looking at they made fake sink drains, and they looked at what happened when you used antimicrobial detergent on the microbes in those sink drains. And one of the things that happened is that the microbial composition changed, and there was lower diversity, essentially because a group of bacteria that could use some of those antimicrobial compounds were becoming much more abundant. And so, you know, if you're using antimicrobial dish soaps, for example, you're not getting rid of microbes, you're favoring a different subset. And so we do this all over the place.
And could we be killing good microbes to get rid of the bad?
We could be, yes.
Should we take some calls? Our number here? Okay, well, just let's go to this first call. It is from Larry from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, excuse me. I'm currently being treated for a condition called C. difficile, and I'm pretty sure they'll be familiar with it, but I'm just curious. It's contracted in hospital, and I'm wondering, can it also be contracted or spread in the home? Because I'm told by the medical people that it's much more frequent and severe and is becoming more difficult to treat. And yet tens of thousands of people apparently get sick from this. It affects the colon. Can they tell us any more about that in general?
Have you found any C. difficile in your home samples, Rob?
Well, I haven't tested, you know, in the home for it, but I'm thinking, you know, if those spores are present, where would they be likely to, you know, manifest themselves, and what do you do to combat that?
Well, maybe Rob knows the answer.
I mean, it's known to be present on this. I mean, even without worrying about the home, it's present on the skin of lots of people who don't have it as a pathogen, and so it's actually, I mean, it's very common, and one of the most common situations in which it becomes a problem is in the context of use of lots of antibiotics. And so, I mean, it's an interesting case example of a problem we create by using antimicrobials in general too much. That's not the only time it's a problem, but it's very, very common in that context. And so, I mean, one of the amazing things about C. diff is that one of the treatments that's being used now to fight Clostridium difficile is to get a fecal transplant, in which you essentially get a dose of the microbes from somebody else to help recolonize your gut and sort of beat back the C. diff. I mean, it's the kind of thing that as ecologists we would expect to see in an agricultural field or a forest, and we're seeing it on bodies. And so, I mean, it's a really serious, really common problem, but it very directly is a manifestation of the overuse of antibiotics, not necessarily in a cholera's particular case, but in generally speaking.
Well, Larry brings up the whole issue of hospitals, and we hear that people get sick for all sorts of reasons when they're in hospitals, from Staphylococcus and MRSA, MRSA. Is it the way the hospitals are built or the way that they're cooled and heated that leads to that? Why do bacteria and other viruses and fungi seem to thrive in hospitals?
Jess, do you want to go for this one?
Yeah, sure. I think that there's a lot of it could have to do with the cleaning regimes of hospitals. It could be due to the nature of hospitals that their people have compromised immune systems that go to the hospitals, or that they are sick when they come to the hospital in the first place. But also, hospitals have design codes that are fundamentally different than something that you would find in the home, for example, where they require filtering air and treating air to keep it at a very narrow band of temperature and relative humidity. And many hospitals, it's against building code to allow patients in outpatients rooms, for example, to just open their windows. And so we published a study showing how fundamentally different airborne bacteria are in a hospital in rooms where you're allowed to open the windows versus rooms where the hospital is running business as usual.
Now, is opening windows good? We use the term fresh air and open a window to get it. How is the air outside compared to the air inside? Are we less likely to be bringing in a lot of the microbes that we've been talking about?
Well, what we found was that it's very intuitive, if you keep the windows closed, you have a very different type of bacteria in the air, outside versus inside. The indoor air tends to have a lot of microbes that are found in and on your skin, and we also found that the DNA sequences from the airborne microbes, there were more of them that were closely related to known pathogens. And if you open the windows, then you have a lot more microbes that are commonly found in the outdoor environment, like in bodies of water and on plants and in dirt, and a much lower proportion of potential pathogens.
Now, we can't open up the window in an airplane. And, Rob, people often worry about the quality of air in closed spaces like airplanes. Have you looked into that?
We haven't looked at airplanes. There is some work, but not a lot. I mean, one of the interesting things, is to think about in the multiple ways that microbes are affecting you. And so one way is the way we tend to worry about is pathogens, is things that, you know, you go on a plane, what's happening with the air, how is it affecting your body? But the other is sort of the more chronic exposure to microbes. And so there's a lot of work now suggesting really beneficial effects of having certain kinds of microbes or certain diversity of microbes in terms of your body's health, in terms of immune health. I mean, one of the really neat recent studies in this regard was a study in Finland in which teenagers who lived in more rural and more urban areas were compared in terms of their allergies, and then their houses were studied in terms of the species living outside and inside and on their bodies. And to make the long story short, those teenagers who had a greater biodiversity of native plants outside had different microbial composition on their skin and were less likely to have allergies. And so in addition to whatever specific acute problem we worry about from the air on a plane, we have these longer term things that are affecting how our bodies work that I actually think are far more important than the things we tend to be more likely to worry about.
Now, we started by talking about communities of microbes. How do they work? Do they function as a group? Do they interact with each other?
Yeah, microbes are just like plants and animals in that way. So they have ways of communicating with one another and competing with each other. They evolve. Any of the principles that you think of in terms of complex ecosystems with life that we can see with our eyes, those very similar principles operate with life that we can't see with our naked eye.
Yeah, I mean, just to take one example, so if your listeners have stinky feet, one of the most common bacteria that produces stinky feet is a Bacillus subtilis. And that bacterial species also produces large quantities of antimicrobial compounds. And so it's in active war with the other species on your feet or in your belly button or wherever else. And so, I mean, there are all these amazing, Shakespearean dramas taking place at small, small scales. Everywhere you look but see nothing.
Let's take a call from John from Paramus. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Can you tell us a little about the toothbrush? I know they're full of kind of microbes, and what we can do to prevent it or keep them sanitary?
Do toothpastes actually fight against the bad microbes, the pathogens on our toothbrushes?
I don't know the oral literature too well. Jess, do you know?
Can you repeat the question?
Well, he was worried about the microbes on our toothbrushes.
Oh, so... I know that your toothbrush is loaded with tens of thousands of bacteria that can live there, just like any environment. But I don't know that much about how the best practices for managing your toothbrush.
Rob, you've been on the show before to talk about how species living in isolated environments in New York City, like medians on Broadway, have led to evolutionary changes in those species. And we have very little time, but is there evidence that microbes might evolve in the same way when they're in isolated communities?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, so I think there are all kinds of great evolutionary stories in our houses. One that we know something about is that in hot water heaters, there's a kind of bacteria of the genus Thermus. And its closest relatives live in hot springs, like right. In Yellowstone.
And we leave it there, unfortunately. Rob Dunn and Jessica Green, thank you both so much for being on our show today.
Thank you.
Thank you.